digging deeper into the lives, the stories, and the passions of people on today's education landscape. This is In Conversation on Voice Ed Radio. I'm your host, Stephen Hurley. Well, thank you for joining me for another episode of In Conversation. This one also part of the series Restore Factory Settings? And we are heading closer and closer to returning to schools, not returning to normal, but reopening of schools. I am pleased to be welcoming today to the Voice Ed Radio airwaves Dr. Steve Sider, Dr. Artavan Zedarad, both faculty members at Wilfrid Laurier University's Faculty of Education. Their recent article in The Conversation, Schools After Coronavirus. I love the subtitle, Seize Teachable Moments About Racism and Inequities. Stay tuned for our conversation. Well, it's a lot to dig into. We've had a number of conversations on returning to school. This one promises to bring a little more, well, a different sort of depth, different sort of insight. Steve and Artavan, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for having us. It's great to spend some time talking about these important issues with you.
Well, they are important issues. And I wanted to jump right in. And, you know, we use terms like exclusion. We use terms like systemic racism and marginalization. All of these terms floating around not only academia, but now more and more traditional media. For those of us that aren't involved in these conversations on a day-to-day basis and not doing the depth of research and writing about them that you two are, how do we, the rest of us, actually recognize what systemic racism, marginalization, all of those inequity terms, how do we recognize them in our own school communities and provinces and right across the country, Steve?
Yeah, it's such an important question. And I feel like in many ways, the interaction that Artavan and I have had over the last 6 months or so serves, for me at least, as a little bit of a model of how we enter into these conversations, how we recognize aspects of inequity and so forth. Because I think it really is an aspect of relationships, that the more we are in relationship with those who are on the margins or who might see themselves on the margins or who might see themselves as excluded from kind of mainstream society, the more we have those relationships, the more we have conversations, the more we experience or come to understand a little bit of the lived experience of the other. And so Artavan is a relatively new faculty member at Laurier. I've been there for a number of years. As he's come into the faculty and has raised really important questions around, particularly around some of the experiences that we've seen highlighted in the news over the last few months, and which we know as you know have gone on for decades and centuries. You know, with Canada's history with Indigenous peoples and other people of color, Chinese immigrants from 150 years, 200 years ago, and so forth. So these are, I think, really comes, to me at least, comes out in those relationships that lead to good conversations, that lead to, for me, learning, understanding. And maybe one thing I'll just say before turning this to Artavan for his input is, you know, my research and my background deals with one aspect of marginalization, and that's for those with disabilities or students with special education needs. So I've looked at this topic often from the perspective and from the with the voice of those who experience marginalization from that perspective. But you know, I'm a white male. It's a different process to experience or to understand the experiences of those who experience marginalization for other reasons. And I think that's also helpful to understand. How do we come to understand these things is to say, well, how do I understand it from a particular perspective, a particular background, or a particular experience? And can I use that as an opportunity or as a way to enter into the experiences or at least come to understand the experiences of others who experience marginalization for other reasons, whether that's because of race or socioeconomics or because of gender and so forth?
Artavan, I remember the first time I encountered these conversations. I was actually teaching on secondment at OISE UT and was teaching specifically a school and society course where the curriculum required that we delve into issues of racism and systemic inequity. I remember my students, their experience of that and some of that resistance. And I remember thinking to myself, how come I didn't have this lens before? Now you're teaching at faculty. Do you have similar experiences with your students, and how do you get them to see things differently?
Yeah, I mean, a great question. I mean, I think the resistance is still probably there, you know, whether it was many years ago that you experienced it while teaching. I think talking to a lot of colleagues who are teaching about equity issues, and when they talk about, you know, whiteness, white supremacy, systemic anti-Black, anti-Indigenous racism, some people naturally feel uncomfortable about it. And so I think the strategy, and I've gotten better at doing this over the years, is you first got to invest a little bit of time creating a sense of community in your classes for people to feel safe and for people to feel okay disagreeing with each other. The goal is not for everybody to think the same by end of a course or talking about equity issues. We're all going to be on our own trajectories, given our lived experiences, our religion, culture, our backgrounds. And so our circle of friends in the community is in win. We're all in. I think the goal is to plant the seed and let that seed blossom. It will take some unlearning. It will take some relearning. It'll take an attitude of wanting to learn more. But I think the first step is willing to engage in dialogue, to consider a different perspective than what you take for granted. And I think my strategy has always been to poke holes to what is always accepted as the norm. A lot of friends and talk about, for example, that's common sense. And I always say, well, common sense is socially constructed. If I take what's common to you as common sense and take you to a different part of the world in a different community, if you do that, you might stand out. And so I'm always trying to disrupt the trajectory of judgment, the value system that they judge. And I think, as I said, it goes back to that dialogue. And the important question to always ask is why. So, for example, if somebody feels that a certain social group steals more than others, I might try to put them in a different position to reevaluate that situation. So I might say, well, why would someone steal, right? I mean, we can all agree that stealing is bad, but why would someone steal? Would you steal, for example, if you didn't have any money, or your grandmother or your son or daughter was dying and you needed to get the medication by all costs for them to survive? So now the power dynamics of a situation really makes the situation much more complex than a simple yes or no. And I think that's what it is when you're doing the work of equity and disrupting people's thinking and questioning systemic issues. There's a lot of times people are looking at it from an individual lens of this is a good person or a bad person. But I think on a larger scale, especially when the faculty of ed, we are examining these issues from a much more macro lens of a systemic approach and why these problems have existed for so many years historically, socially, politically, economically, and why it has resulted in inequality of opportunity, particularly for certain groups, racialized, minoritized, indigenous, Black, and so forth, Muslim. So I think that's just the approach. I'm sure we're going to delve more into it, but it all starts with engaging in a dialogue. And the emotional piece is part of doing the equity work. You cannot do the equity work and try to sideline the emotional piece. You actually have to embrace it and delve into it and process it and heal from it in order to become better at it and to become a better person to really live this lifestyle with a consciousness about equity and social justice issues.
I wanted to point out, Artavan, from my perspective, there's a recognition problem. As you say, you know, you can pretty well recognize acts of racism or acts of, you know, a disposition that maybe discriminates against a particular person or a group of people. But when it comes to systemic issues, they're a little more tangled and complex and more difficult to see. When we're talking about systemic racism, for example, and COVID-19 presenting a way of someone used the phrase blacklighting, you know, something that we see in the context of that blacklight, but maybe don't see when the lights are on. Tell me about recognizing systemic racism and how important it is we continue to focus on recognizing that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think that's a common rebuttal people might make when you are engaging in these issues and trying to shed light on systemic inequities. I think for me, the best way is to then, once we start engaging in that dialogue and have that safe space, provide them with some numbers, because, you know, some people, you know, they really want the proof. And there's lots of great studies that have a lot of Canadian context. You know, you could look at international context, and just to kind of throw some things out, and this goes historically to, you know, lots of different practices, but in education, you know, you can look at Jean Annion in the 1980 ethnography of social class and the hidden curriculum of work, where, you know, students from higher socioeconomic status are getting much more experiential learning, and whereas schools in racialized and minoritized communities are getting a very remote learning focused on behaviorism and mannerism. You know, in Canada, we can look at vertical poverty, Poverty by Postal Code, a 2011 study done by the United Way, where we look at communities that are overpopulated are really fighting for resources and social support services, how inaccessibility to those from a social determinants of health perspective really impacts their lifestyle, their social and emotional health. You could also look at rebalancing the opportunity equation. Another United Way report came out 2019. Or you can also look at the color of poverty, color of change fact sheets, which look at the different institutions and how there's an overrepresentation of so many social groups that are consistently been marginalized by Canada and Ontario, and how in order to be equitable and in order to be fair, we need to kind of become aware that these things are systemic, that it's not a one and done, and that we as a collective, as educators, community activists, practitioners, we need to engage in these dialogues in order to try to create those accessibilities, those opportunities for them to do better. Now, equality of outcome might be a bit too idealistic, but let's at least try to make sure the process itself is as equitable and fair as possible for people to get those opportunities to then lead to the outcomes that they need to in order to bring the best out of them.
If I could just jump in on that too, Stephen, I think to extend what Artavan has said, and this is part of, I think this is illustrative of why I have enjoyed just the opportunity to engage in conversation with Artavan. I think this is why it's so important for all of us who are involved with education, whether it's in, you know, K-12, elementary and secondary education or higher education, to have these conversations and to not be afraid of them. But I think this illustrates the importance of being able to say, okay, tell me more about that. Help me understand what's happening historically, or what you're seeing in your own communities, what I'm seeing in my communities. And that ability to have conversation is such a critical aspect of what we do as educators. I don't remember who said it. It's an old saying, this idea that we're all ignorant. We're just ignorant of different things. That might be a Mark Twain saying or something like that. But, you know, I think that speaks to our own mindset to say, we haven't got this all figured out. So when people throw out terms like systemic racism, and our immediate response is, well, no, that doesn't happen in my community, or that doesn't happen in the sector I work, is to say, well, can we just take a time out, so to speak, to let's dig into this a little bit more. What are you referring to by systemic racism, and where's the evidence for systemic racism, and what do I need to read to develop better understanding or greater depths of understanding in a particular area, that sometimes the terminology can be jarring and off-putting for people, but that can't be a place where we just stop then and say, well, I just disagree. In other ways we can look at this in kind of modern culture as things like, masking and not wearing a mask or not wanting to be involved with vaccines. And people just have this immediate, almost visceral response to say, well, that's just not that's not my reality. So that's clearly not the reality for anyone else. And I think that just is that idea of developing that mindset of saying, what can I learn and how can I engage in a conversation to learn more about this particular topic? Stephen, I don't know if you remember, you might remember, like this is going back 30 years or so ago, but there was a great book that Jonathan Kozol wrote. He was a teacher in Boston, became a sociologist, and it's called Savage Inequalities. I reread it this summer, and it just reminded me that the systemic issues and the evidence that Artavan just pointed to have been, this is not a new aspect of education, right? We know that there's been systemic barriers to education that have been ongoing for decades. I read this, and I'm just going to share this quote because it's really stuck with me and resonated with me when I reread this book from Jonathan Kozol. This, he's referring to the inequities, or the equities, when, you know, when schools attempt to address inequities. He says that often what happens is that, and here I quote, something close enough to equity to silence criticism by approximating justice, but far enough from equity to guarantee the benefits enjoyed by privilege. And that, when I reread that again this summer, it struck me that that often is what happens when we respond to these aspects of systemic racism or marginalization of different communities. Again, whether those, the whole range of what those communities might be, do we do just enough to make it seem like, okay, we're getting close to an equitable or a just situation, but not quite to the degree that needs to happen? It approximates justice, but doesn't actually get to justice. So that's been a reminder to me to say that the work that we have to do isn't just a one and done situation, but for all of us who work in this space, it's a matter of a continual process of learning and unlearning and relearning and engaging in conversation so that we can do better.
I want to come back to that. And as a matter of fact, I have Jonathan's book, Letters to a Young Teacher, sitting right beside me.
Fantastic.
Yeah, no, I love his writing. Artavan, I know you wanted to pick up on some of what Steve was saying.
I just want to kind of jump on that and just make two points, kind of going back to language. There's two things, right? We all wear different hats and we're in different positions based on the different circles we're in. So the language I use to talk about these issues will change based on who I'm talking to. And, you know, in the literature, we call it code switching. Like, you're not going to be swearing and cussing at your parents, and you might act differently than when you're talking to a colleague or your close friends, right? So the power dynamic is always at play. Instead of equity, you know, I might be use the word fairness when I'm talking to certain circles and so forth. So I think the language has to be tailored to the situation and who you're talking to. And going back to language, there's two things I want to emphasize. One is the difference between equality and equity. And for a lot of people in education, I think that might be taken for granted. But it takes a lot of time for me and my classes to really deconstruct this within depth, because most people think treating everybody the same is being fair. When in fact, we know that's not true in education. We don't treat everybody the same. If the same kid says the exact same words, it could be interpreted totally different, and different consequences dished out based on their identity and who it is and where it's said. So recognizing that one, equity is fairness and equality is sameness, and we stick with only equality, there's the power dynamics will never align to give equality of opportunity to different social groups. The other rebuttal and the pushback I get is when we talk about systemic racism, people will always give me a scenario that's an exception to it. So the way for me to rebuttal that is there can always be exceptions. For example, you have somebody who comes from a single parent household who's born in poverty, but does really, really great, overcome all the odds and achieves. What do we do as an institution or a society? We put them on a pedestal and say, if they can do it, you can do it too. But that's an exception. So if I took 100 people and gave them those same poor circumstances, maybe 1, 2, or 10 out of 100 will rise above it. So when we talk about systemic racism, we're actually talking about probabilities. We're talking about the other 90 who didn't make it and not the 10 that made it. Those are the exceptions. So if you want to turn that into numbers, it'd be the same thing, right? If you look at the makeup of the general population relative to race and religion and who is being suspended in our schools, who is making up the jails, that there's a clear overrepresentation of not by 1, 2, 3, 4%, but it's a gross overrepresentation. Now, let me get a little methodology. Like, that could be interpreted from a deficit lens and say, well, it's because those people commit crime or they don't want to study. But we have to look at a much more complex, systemic, larger lens of, well, what has led to those outcomes? And so, you know, those are the two key words I wanted to brought up: difference between equality and equity, and then talking about probabilities, which is a systemic lens, versus exceptions, which is a very individualistic neoliberal lens that unfortunately has become very normalized within many of our institutions.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, Artavan. Andy Hargreaves, in his recent book, Moving, which is his memoir about education and social mobility, reflects on the fact that in England, which is one of the prime examples of class in the world, he claims, some studies have been done that, you know, that push back against the idea that certain groups are held from becoming upwardly mobile. And but he also points out that the studies that were done actually looked at families that had experienced a type of backward mobility, so their motivation and the means to regain that sense of mobility was different than someone that didn't have those in the first place. And I think it was a very interesting example of I think what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And so, I mean, but when it really hits home, I think it's much different when just talking about it theoretically or learning about it.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to pick up on that language piece, and this is something that's been on my mind for a while, and it came back to my mind when I read your article in The Conversation, and it's who gets to choose the language, who is in control of the language. And it strikes me that if we're using terms like marginalized communities and socioeconomic status and Black, Indigenous, people of color, it's automatically people in power, in control of the language that are marginalizing and those marginalized groups, the people that we're talking about, automatically become the other. Am I just making that up, or is there something there to be concerned about?
Well, I'll jump in here really quickly. This is, I think it's a brilliant question and really interesting to ponder. I mean, we know that language is powerful, obviously, and language has been used in, I mean, we can look at a whole variety of ways, you know, language of colonization, the language of that continues to be English continues to be a world dominant language. So there's that whole level of how language is powerful. And if we look at it from the use of terms, I think there is definitely a possibility that language can serve to frame kind of a binary of us them. But language also serves as a starting point for a conversation. And I'll use the example, in the research area that I work in as far as disability, that the term disability or disabled is a very contentious term. The term autism is a term that has various, people have various perspectives on when we talk about a person with autism, or how do, you know, there's been this whole movement towards people first language as opposed to language that is used to kind of identify or isolate a person. So language is certainly in everything we do and has the potential to frame things in certain ways that might make people uncomfortable. And in fact, I think that's not a bad thing. I think sometimes to be uncomfortable is a good thing. And to say, okay, well, again, what is it about the language that might seem like it's othering? What is it that's bothering me about this language? Black, Indigenous, people of color is a term that's become much more common, I would say, in the last couple of years than it would have been a number of years ago. So again, why is that? What can we learn from that? And again, this is where I see that opportunity to have conversation, which is so, seems in so many ways lacking, to say, well, what is it about this language that might be helpful? And what about it is problematic? And what language can we use that's more clear, that gives a space or a place for us to enter, for multiple people to enter and not feel like there's automatically barriers there. So those are just some initial thoughts. I'd be curious, Artavan, what do you think as far as this idea of the othering that language can present?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Steve has pointed out, you want to discuss language early on because these terms have been defined in so many different ways by so many different discourses and platforms. So it's good to kind of be on the same page that when I say systemic racism, what do I mean by that? When I say whiteness or white supremacy, what do I mean by that? I always try to bring it to the big picture, and I use this, I call it the triangle of power and change in my classes. At the bottom of this triangle, you have the power of ideas and individuals. And I think this is what we're talking about. We're at the grassroots level where we want to engage in these important ideas And for those ideas to carry weight, we are having conversations with individuals. And when these conversations pick up momentum and more people pick up on it, and I think maybe that's where we are in this snapshot of a moment with the rise of anti-Indigenous, anti-Black movements that are happening all around the world, inspired kind of by George Floyd, the death of George Floyd, but long in the making before that. Maybe that seems like it was a tipping point. The conversation is now take it to the next level. At the top of the triangle of power and change is tackling institutions and their policies and practices. I mean, historically, a lot of times institutions and their policies and practices have not supported equitable outcomes. And I always, you know, tell students, at one point, the government and schools told you it's actually better to have segregated schools. This was supported by the law and policies and bylaws and so forth. So it took a lot of sacrifice, a lot of uphill battle, and in reality, a lot of lost lives in order for society to accept and engage in those conversations and say, you know what, maybe we got it wrong and we need to change this policy and our approach and our value system. And I think we are at that next generation momentum where we are trying to tackle what has become normalized in our education system as being neutral, as not taking a stance, as you know, being silent because there are quote unquote uncomfortable conversations. And my response to that, or to the students who I feel kind of getting nervous, it's okay to feel uncomfortable. It's okay to feel guilty. The question is, what are you going to do to those feelings? Because as I said, part of learning is the social emotional piece, and we can't negate that because we know if we do, our students will suffer and we won't have the fruitful and the depth of conversations we need to have to truly engage in altering these power dynamics on a systemic level.
Artavan, you mentioned the idea of segregated classrooms or segregated schools. And again, I think this is part of that process of learning and unlearning, transitioning, moving forward and sideways and so forth. Is we still have segregated schools and classes in Ontario today. I think of students with significant disabilities are often in segregated settings. It might even be in a class, but they're segregated in that space. I think that's a systemic issue that sometimes this is one of the, I guess I would say one of the dangers when we think of issues of equity or inequity as kind of silos. So we look at equity or inequity from the perspective of gender or from the perspective of religion or from the perspective of language or race or whatever it might be. And I think there's an argument to be made that we need to be looking at these issues again systemically, or I would say holistically, to recognize that there are groups that are marginalized that might not be a focus area. And I'm thinking again particularly of those with disabilities who, you know, there's been recent reports again just coming out in the last day or two about the economic outcome of those with disabilities in this country as a result of COVID. So, you know, we have to be thinking about these issues as holistic, to say what groups or what people or what students, individuals are at the margins, and to recognize it's not just issues based on these silos, but they're across different groups that we need to be mindful of and work in a concerted or cohesive way to address those areas.
What's interesting, we use the word intersectionality increasingly these days, and you have me thinking about schools, for example, as being really nested systems. They're nested within other social systems that we need to take a look at. So this is a good opportunity to recognize where those points of intersection are and how we can maybe address these in a different way. And it's a good opportunity to jump into your article, which is what brought us here together. And you talk in Schools After Coronavirus about really seizing and leveraging those teachable moments. It's a phrase that is often assigned to teachers thinking about their students. And it has me thinking about who are the students at this time? And perhaps we could jump in as students and take a look at those two critical events that you have identified. And we've already touched a little bit on the social reaction and action that took place after the George Floyd killing. What does this allow us to do, not only as school systems, but as a larger social project? And what can we take from it? Artavan, when you think of the social movements that have bubbled up and continue to take place across the country, what's in store for us if we really embrace those?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely a lot we can think about and engage with. For me, I think the reality is that the current system as it was pre-COVID or pre-pandemic, it was not working for a lot of social groups. When we think about, you know, higher to lower socioeconomic status particularly, and then when we add that layers of intersectionality in from a race, gender, religion, sexuality perspective. And so I think this is a moment for us to almost, you know, take a deep breath and take some time as educators, as administrators, as politicians to listen. And when I say listen is, as much as we listen to the data and the quantitative data that comes out, let's take some time to listen to the pain and the suffering and the lived experiences of the identities and communities really disadvantaged by the circumstances perpetuated and really exacerbated by the pandemic. We know certain neighborhoods, they are really hit the hardest, particularly under-resourced, racialized communities. And so we have to think about what wasn't in place in order to mitigate that disadvantage being felt. And so that's why the conversation, once again, it goes back to that systemic piece, is what do we need to do in order to create opportunities for all neighborhoods and all spaces, whether it's in school or outside of school? Because as you said, we can't talk about these in silos. The school community, they are a collective, and the power dynamics within the school doesn't end when the student, you know, steps out of the school, because it's still part of that same space. And so I think we just need to take some time to listen. It also gives us an opportunity to perhaps try some things. We're not going to get it perfect. And I think a lot of times we sit down and debate extensively about how to do it while we miss the boat. So for example, if I said we need change and I was sitting at a table with 20 people, I think I'm going to get 18 to 19 people to say we need change and agree on that part. But then if I said, well, now let's discuss how are we going to implement new change, that conversation might get 18 or 19 different opinions. And I think that's what we need to do a better job at, of trying to listen a little bit and then just go out there and try something different. Recognize that what was normalized is not working for some people, and we might not get it perfect, but here's an opportunity to say, you know what, we're listening and we're willing to work with you, and to bring in those voices that have historically and socially have been marginalized and don't have a seat at the table. So we can't just have politicians deciding what's going to happen within our education system. They got to consult with educators, administrators, practitioners who are working in schools, but it might not be part of union. I think it's important to capture all those voices and then kind of drive a plan of action from there.
Can I ask you about that that listening process? Because we know what focus groups and consultation protocols look like in this province and beyond. And it's often difficult to walk away feeling that you've actually heard the authentic voices of the people you need to hear from. And I'm thinking there's a trust dimension to it. I know as school council chair, we have a large number of voices that are not around the table. And sometimes it's a trust issue that we need to recognize and nurture before we actually get the people that need to be there in the conversation.
Yeah, and just to jump on that, I think you're absolutely right, Stephen. I mean, trust is a foundational aspect to relationships, right? I mean, you don't typically have relationships unless there's a basis of trust there. And if family members don't, if parents and guardians don't see people in their schools, i.e. teachers and principals and superintendents and directors of education, who they can connect with or that they feel like they can build that trust with. And some of that, I think, is again, back to that systemic issue of who is in charge in these schools. And we've seen just in the last few weeks, a number of directors of education who are women, people of color. And I think that engenders at least a starting point for trust to occur. And I think this is a place where we, in fact, as of education, need to really look deeply at who we are and what we do and who gets in, so to speak, and what are the teachers that we are engaging in the process of eventually becoming teachers in our school systems in Ontario. And I think that's a really a critical aspect. We've talked about this for years, that we continue to perpetuate a very similar group of teachers as have been in teaching positions for decades. I think that the irony, so to speak, in the issue of social movements and the idea of listening, Artavan, right now is there's also this almost hyper franticness, if that's a word, that we are also working with, right? Where we know that this is an important time where we need to be engaging with conversation and listening and working to understand. And yet at the same time, what we're hearing from teachers and principals and what we're seeing is that this almost frantic pace of change because of COVID and because of emergency remote learning but we have to get back in school. And it almost feels like the opportunities for dialogue and for listening are being hijacked by the sense that we need to get back to normalcy, so to speak, in a kind of a typical timeline. And I'm really concerned about that.
I'm wondering whether one of you might speak to one of the teachable moments in the social movement section in this article. It's about place-based learning. And, you know, many people think of place-based learning as an opportunity to get kids outside. Outdoor education is sometimes used as synonymously. There's something more powerful about place-based learning, I sense. And I wanted to pick up on that.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, when I use the term place-based learning, I think for me, it comes back to the power dynamics of a learning environment. And to that learning environment to reflect the needs of the students, the educators, the administrators, you know, the people are living and coming in and out of that space. So, for example, you know, a lot of times we, of course, in education talk about best practices that have proven to be effective in different contexts. But I always kind of put a little asterisk when I see the word best practices. A lot of times we try to copy and paste an initiative and expect the exact same great results. And that doesn't happen because we need to take that great approach or initiative and tailor it to the power dynamics and needs of a place and a space in order for that to work. Copy and paste does not work. And so part of that tailoring process to reflect the needs of the community is being collaborative, is listening, is having key people, considering certain lived experiences, voices, and opinions and perspectives that will help you shed light on what I would call our blind spots as someone coming in from outside of the community. So for me, it always have to be at the grassroots level going up. A lot of times, as we know, change comes top down, and that's why it doesn't really work, because every situation and place is going to have its own unique needs and governed by its own written and unwritten rules. And so we have to take that understanding when we are talking about people's lives, we're talking about people's children, their treasures, you know, that's the most important thing. And with schools about to be opening up, a lot of people don't feel safe sending their most important treasure, their children, to schools because of what is currently suggested. Now, you know, there has been a lot of backlash and things can change from now to the next couple of weeks. But we really have to think about what are the specific needs of that place? And what are we doing to tailor the process to reflect that?
Artavan, can I ask you a question around this? The school boards in Ontario have been able to hire Indigenous knowledge keepers or Indigenous advisors as part of their school board efforts to address the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's, calls to action and efforts to indigenize curriculum and so forth. Do you see that as an effort at place-based learning, i.e. trying to ensure that the learning that occurs in local school contexts takes into consideration Indigenous knowledge and pedagogies? Do you see parallel opportunities for other groups, or do you see that as a problematic process or tokenism? I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that as a model for supporting place-based learning.
I mean, I think it's a great start. It comes down to how it's implemented. Is it performance politics? For example, you kind of create the initiative and it exists for a while and then it goes away? Is this are these positions created more sustainably? I've had so many people share with me that non-Indigenous people are hired for an Indigenous position. That itself is problematic on so many levels. So the implementation part, I think, is the key in terms of getting it right and the power dynamics to reflect the space and the needs of the people within that space. But I think the ideas is always great. It's a step in the right direction, but we can't take our foot off the gas pedal and now say we're happy with it. We need to kind of continue to push forward in order to expand opportunities, in order to create that equality of opportunity that those social groups can do well.
The second critical event you talk about in your article, and I think it's one that's very familiar to us, the conversations had swirled right from the end of March and are still swirling around what has been revealed by the fact that kids were not able to be in school all the time. It's a conversation that tends to center, or has tended to center, on technology and equity issues around that. You had some interesting things to say about that and a couple of important teachable moments and points there.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, that much of my focus in that area has been to do with how do we support those with special education needs in the time of school disruption. And my argument essentially is design with those on the margins first. And if we can do that, then we will be able to support the needs of all students in a just and equitable way. So yeah, the school disruption, certainly, you know, moving to online learning has, you know, laid bare issues of who has access, not just who has access to the laptops and tablets and the internet, but recognizing there's a rural urban divide as well in this province, and many of our students who aren't in urban areas also experience marginalization of sorts because of just access to technology. And then you take into consideration issues around, and I wrote recently another article about this, about synchronous learning opportunities or video conferencing with students, which has challenges, and some of our teaching federations in the province have raised some of those challenges. But for some students, particularly students with special education needs, particularly those who might have really significant needs, needing the ability to engage on a human level, not across a screen or in a distance learning kind of environment, really is critical to their learning, and to recognize that the challenges that has presented to not just to the student, but also to their family, to their caregivers, the people who are trying their very best to support them, has been very clearly a huge and significant challenge for many families in this province.
I think Steve has touched upon it. You know, you want to reflect and think about the identities and the communities on the margins and their needs first, because if you try to center those, you are going to be more holistically capture the wider needs of a certain, you know, space. So for example, if you also think about it, some students, their safe space was going to school. So even though they might have access to technology, the learning environment at home is not ideal. You know, they could be in a hostile, in a space that's filled with trauma in directly and indirectly ways. So how does that impact learning? So it's not a simplistic, do you have an internet connection, can you log on at this time narrative. It's much more complex. And once again, it goes back to those power dynamics and the conditions for learning. You know, is learning a priority if you have to help your parents and contribute to the rent in some capacity, given your age? And even if we were not talking about the pandemic, these situations still existed far before it. If we look in the summer break, we know kids from higher socioeconomic status likely will stay at the same reading, writing, and math level or improve due to the experiential learnings they will get access to over the summer. We know, for example, kids from lower socioeconomic status, they are likely to drop one reading, writing, or math level because of lack of practice, because a lot of time gets spent playing video games, or due to lack of access to a babysitter or a caring adult, a lot of time is spent at home watching television. And so these inequities, and I think this is what we were talking about, was one of the main things behind the article we co-wrote together, me and Steve, is these inequities have existed. They're now getting some attention because of the pandemic, because of coronavirus. But this is not a fashion show. You know, when schools open up, we can't forget about this. we need to constantly battle and battle and have this conversation and center it until we are able to actually challenge these power dynamics. Maybe we realign certain practices in schools in order to address those needs and in order for those students to get a fair shot at bringing out their potential and the best in them.
And Artavan, when you look at the plans that are starting to emerge across this province and across the country, and boards are now releasing their implementation plans, do you see a centering of those issues that you and Steve have highlighted?
Well, I mean, I think for me, right now, there's so much on administrators' plates, if I could use that analogy. I think the safety conversation is number one. You know, we know with the younger age groups, masks not being mandatory, many teachers are feeling overwhelmed or not safe to return to school at this point until there's some more assurances. So I think equity is in the conversation or in the soup, but it's not the first ingredient right now. I think, once again, with the rise of the movements and the social movements we've been having, it's going to become part of those conversations when the safe school plans are finalized. And I think that goes back to us and in our various positionalities and communities we're involved to make sure these conversations are not forgotten about and that we bring them up at the right time. And doing the work of equity, another layer I always bring up is being strategic. And I think we have the momentum right now and we need to capitalize on it because, as I said, right, if those power dynamics don't change, then this just becomes a phase. It just became something affiliated with the pandemic and it's easy to resume to normal, which a lot of people kind of do want. But as a lot of articles have stated, you know, there is no resuming to normal. It's just going to be a new reality that we have to get used to. So there's a lot to juggle. But hopefully, you know, we're going to do better than where we were before.
And I think you've made an important point that people that were expecting things to change overnight may be a little disappointed by what they're hearing now. But just to take heart that, you know, if we hold these issues in front of people and there are, you know, I think that is going to happen, then those changes will stand a better chance of taking root. And Steve, I wanted to turn to a question that you were actually raising around what people like you and people of privilege, not only in terms of socioeconomic status, but gender and race and positionality in terms of those institutions. What is necessary there? Because there's a bit of stubbornness, resilience, resistance to change, as the Jonathan Cozell quote indicated. So what are you thinking these days in terms of the work that needs to be done?
Yeah, you know, to be really frank, it's a struggle, and which I don't think is a bad thing. I think that there's a comfort level that comes with privilege, and it's good to be pushed out of that comfort zone. You know, we need to recognize there's lots of things that have been done well in education, and this shouldn't just be about bashing education, right? Justice Sinclair made that comment even out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Like, if education was part of the reason that got us into this problem, it can also be part of the solution, so to speak. And so I think we need to recognize there's things that we have addressed. And again, I think from a disability lens, we've made great strides and great improvement as far as inclusion of those with disabilities in this province. And yet we need to keep focusing on what remains broken. So it's not just, you know, considering everything as problematic, but to say, yes, we've seen some good success, but that's not the end of the story. We're still continuing in the journey. Carolyn Shields, who does a lot of work in, you know, the idea of transformative leadership, talks about this idea too of kind of continually striving for critiquing what's happening and you know, recognizing that we need to continue to address both individual and corporate issues. And I think that's where I'm really coming at this kind of place in my own career and that my own positionality is to say, how do I continue to learn myself? How do I support my colleagues like Artavan? How do I go beyond just supporting my colleagues to also being an advocate and a leader, a transformative or aim to be a transformative leader who can join in the fight to ensure that our schools are good places, that our schools are places where everyone is welcomed, where they are hospitable, where people are embraced, Students are embraced, teachers are embraced, family members are embraced, and so forth. So that's where I'm at in kind of my own journey with this, is to work both at that individual level of learning and reading. I had some great reading that I've engaged with this summer around, you know, some amazing Black authors and Indigenous authors, and learning through that process, but also saying that it's not good enough just to stop at the individual level, but to say, how do we work for corporate or for macro change as well?
Artevan, I'm wondering, this is part of the work that you do at the faculty. These conversations are something you have with your students as part of that work. Are you thinking of starting those conversations differently in September when students, whatever way they come back to you, come back? Is this experience changed the starting point for you?
I mean, I think I the process, I try to always tailor it based on the demographics, the maturity level of the students in a given class. So I think every time I do it, even though it might be the same content, it's always tailored to meet the power dynamics in the room. So I would always have to take some time before I delve into these topics to get to know the students. You know, sometimes there's more pushback. Sometimes you can digest materials at a faster rate. But I think there's so much content that is practical and out there in our current context that I can right away bring in as a starting point to engage in those conversations. So my goal is to start kind of planning my courses for the fall over the next week or two. But I think it goes back to what Steve said, is I always try to bring it back to the micro and the macro and not just focus on one aspect. And there's lots of easy ways, because when you make people relate to these issues within the circles of their lives, they're starting to engage with it more. And there's some common examples I use is, you know, if your friend makes a racist joke, how are you going to respond? Are you going to laugh along, or, you know, are you going to try to address it in some way, whether it's serious or low key, right? For some students, I ask, you know, if you took a partner home of a different race, religion, or sexuality, how receptive will your parents be? And then I'll say, how receptive might your grandparents be? And of course, a lot of times, like, oh, you know, they're going to see it differently. And I say, well, why do you think they see it differently? Why don't you have a conversation with them about their lived experiences and so forth? And so I think I try those little tactics to bring it home. But once again, it's always about the larger piece. Eventually, you know, it sounds cliche, but, you know, a journey starts with small steps, and we all have to do our work in order to do the heavy lifting. And so at the systemic level, and I always say within education and many institutions, you know, there's a lot of policies and practices, but there's also a lot of flexibility. And I use the word subversion, and I've written on this with John Portelli from U of T. The best way to put it is, you don't have to break the rules, but sometimes there's wiggle room to bend the rules in order to be equitable. And so that goes with a little bit of risk taking. That goes into your positionality and what you're comfortable with. But we all need to do a little bit of risk taking, whether it's our own emotions or the practices we do, in order to do the work of equity. And the more people we can get on board, eventually we can have that systemic turnover effect and continue to build on it.
We just have a couple of minutes to make this a full hour episode, which is increasingly common here at Voice Ed Radio. But I'm wondering, there are people listening, there are educators listening, there may be parents listening, new teachers, teachers that have been around for a while. We know that learning is tough, and unlearning is even tougher. Some small steps, either a book that people might want to pick up. Your article certainly is a good starting point, but maybe just a piece of advice for people that are wanting to be on the road, may feel a little lonely at times, but want to keep going. Artevan.
I mean, for me, I think I would say it starts with conversations, and it starts with role modeling, because the early years are so, so important. What's also important is ask your children the question that they always ask you when they're young. Why? So, for example, if you get a phone call from an educator or something happens at school and maybe your child said something that was inappropriate, instead of just delving into lecturing them about language and this and that, start by figuring out why they said that in that context. Like, why did you feel that way? Why did you say that? As a result of what? And when you can understand how someone else is perceiving the world, whether it's an age difference, whether it's a race difference, whether it's a religion difference, you are better situated to have that conversation that it's effective. For example, I always give the example of, you know, when I was a high school and elementary school teacher, I always coached sports. And when I coach sports, some of the children who were, you know, behaviorally disruptive in certain classes, they were totally different when they were in the context of sports. And that really helped them. And when I had that report, I can now have certain conversations, and they respected me and I respected them. And so I think it starts with relationship building, whether it's our own children or others, you know, doing the work of equity. My job is not to get you to think like me. My job is for you to ask why and go on that journey of trying to understand an issue and grapple with it. And, you know, people will arrive at, you know, I use the analogy of a train station. You get on at different times, you get out at different times, but the goal is to eventually get there. And so you can't penalize people for being on a different pace or on a timeline than you. But the goal is to have these fruitful, engaging conversations. That's on a theoretical level, you know, just to quickly on a practical level, you know, expose children to diversity early on, read books with different characteristics. You know, a friend of mine, Kenesha Bido, wrote the book, Shades of Me, which focuses on shadism. Have these important conversations. Don't think children and don't have agency. Don't think because it'll make them feel uncomfortable, they will shy away. Matter of fact, if we don't have those conversations, it's more harmful. So that would be my suggestions.
Steve Sider, last word to you.
I think Artavan's given some great ideas there. And I would just echo the train metaphor and to say there's really no excuse for us not to engage in the process of learning and unlearning, because, you know, there are resources available for those of us who like to read. There's great books, you know, Ibram Kendi's book, which is, you know, a bestseller and has been for months. Austin Channing Brown's work has been great. Indigenous authors, Kevin Lamoureux and Jesse Thistle. There's great resources that are available for those of us who like to read. There's also, I mean, for kind of social media accessibility, you know, thinking of the Sarah Coopers of the world and kind of the TikToks and the Instagram posts that can really resonate with students. And sometimes we might see those as being trite or really light, but they can serve as entrance points that can lead to further learning and understanding. And again, back to Artavan's comment about, you know, just questioning why things are the way they are and what's our role in again, making the world a better place. So I mean, music's a great tool that can be used. Drama, art, there are so many tools that are available for us to engage in learning about the other that I think it's just a matter not so much of types of tools, but it's a matter of will and desire and making the effort.
Well, I appreciate you making the effort, both of you, Artavan and Steve. Just a shout out on the book list this week on Voice Ed Radio, Kalinda Klein begins her third book study. This one is Robin Maynard's Policing Black Lives, and that'll be a multi-week journey through that book. And so lots of great suggestions there. Steve Sider, Artavan Azidarad, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for giving your time and insights, and thanks for the article in Conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. It's always a pleasure, and thanks for the important work you're doing.
You are listening to Voice Ed Radio. This is In Conversation with me, Stephen Hurley. Again, the article, I said In Conversation, it was at The Conversation, two different things. Schools After Coronavirus, Seize Teachable Moments About Racism and Inequities. Highly recommended.